You're going to love this. Just love it.
Are we at war yet? Is that what that bell means? What does that mean? Is that... We need a countdown clock. Countdown to war on the radio. Do we have one of those? All, you know, all the cable news services, they've got a countdown clock. We need a countdown clock. Okay, Desi, let me know if war breaks out. If we have any war before the show is over, just break right on in and let me know about the war. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. Stuck in the middle with you, Brad Friedman. Right here on your Bradcast, I am Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com with you for a live hour right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, and of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, on the Stitcher app, on the TuneIn app, on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio and Liberal Justice Radio. You can run, but you can't hide from us. Glad to be with you this afternoon. A very busy news week, a very busy day. A lot to get to on the show today. So let me get right to it. First off, just in note of September 11th, this is the 12th anniversary, our friend John Fugel sang tweets today. 12 years ago today, America was attacked by zero Iraqis and zero Afghans. Remember 9/11, never forget. Good reminder, John Fugel saying. Okay, we've got a new NSA story today based on new Edward Snowden disclosures. For those of you who trust the Obama administration to not do anything untoward with your personal private information, okay, do you also trust Israel with that same private information of yours, of American citizens? Well, apparently you have to, according to today's new disclosures. We will get to that a little bit later in the show. Also, later in the show, last week we talked about SB 360 out here in California, a terrible, terrible new election reform bill that was sailing its way through the state legislature last week. It has now passed the legislature. It is now on its way to Governor Jerry Brown for his signature, and unless it's stopped with a veto, which I hope is the case. Because this insane new bill, and I mean insane, will also do away with all federal testing for new electronic voting systems across the state of California. And worse than that, it will give extraordinary new powers to the Secretary of State, including allowing the Secretary of State to approve the use of new electronic voting systems in real elections with no certification testing at all. Zero testing, new machines in real elections. It's insane. More on that later in the show, as well as Desi Doyen with the Green News Report will be joining us. But speaking of Desi Doyen and the Green News Report, we begin tonight in Syria. I should say we begin in the Middle East, or rather in the Middle Eastern region. Well, the whole area around there, the Middle and the Far East, well, frankly, the entire globe, actually, and how global warming helped lead directly to the mess that we are now dealing with in Syria today. In one of our Green News reports last week, and we'll have another one later in the show, but in one of our Green News reports last week, I made a snarky joke after Secretary of State John Kerry had appeared at a Pacific Islands forum warning about climate change as those nations were begging for action. They are begging for action from the UN on climate change as their islands are actually disappearing, even as we speak, under rising sea levels. I joked at the time that Kerry's speech last week had convinced me we should bomb global warming immediately. To which my always sharp co-host, yes, talking about you, Desi Doyen, she replied this way during the Green News Report.
Well, you know, actually, there is some analysis that shows that climate change causing drought is also part of the impetus behind the unrest in the Middle East.
See, isn't that just like you? Everything comes back to global warming, doesn't it?
Guess what? Everything does.
All right. Yeah, all right. And of course, I rudely and snarkily dismissed her on that point, mostly for comic effect. But since then, I've spent some time actually looking at this issue, and it is incredibly quite troubling if you look at it in more detail. I did an article at bradblog.com a couple of days ago about this. There has been a decent amount of reporting on it of late, but really only if you go looking for it. The warnings about the national security issues surrounding global warming, they've been made for a while by the Department of Defense and others, and of course, they have been summarily ignored. Or in the case of snarky Green News Report guys like me, they've been, you know, dismissed and jokes have been made about them. But the fact is, if you look into it and if you look into what's going on in Syria right now and the mess that we're facing and a possible new war, you can draw the line directly back to climate change. So, are you skeptical? Are you dubious? I can understand that because, frankly, the media is not out there doing a good job of covering this. They have not been doing a good job covering this for years. We're going to try to change that a little bit today here. I'm joined by Francesco Femia, founding director of the Center for Climate and Security, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank with an advisory board of retired senior military officers and national security experts. Francesco, welcome, sir, to the Bradcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Great to have you here. All right. Back in March of 2012, Climate Progress ran a piece that you co-authored in which you explained that Syria's current social unrest is, in the most direct sense, a reaction to a brutal and out-of-touch regime and a response to the political wave of change that began in Tunisia earlier last year. However, that's not the whole story. You said, as you went on to explain exactly how climate change is tied to Syria. Now, by the way, I will argue that I think if you look at all the information, it's a lot more tied to climate change, I think, than people are willing, even environmentalists are willing to argue. But give us an idea, Francesco, exactly how did climate change help spark the mess we now find ourselves in Syria?
Sure. Well, you know, the national security community, as you've mentioned, it thinks of climate change as a threat multiplier or an accelerant of instability. And essentially what that means is climate change can make other things worse. And those other things are those things that might lead to instability and unrest. And what we noticed in 2011 is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out a report showing that the extended drying and extended droughts in the Mediterranean and the Middle East over the past century were directly linked to climate change. And so that was interesting to us. And we looked at Syria, which was one of those countries that had experienced some of the greatest amount of drying. And we did some research, and we found that from 2006 to 2011, Syria's land experienced, in the terms of one expert, one of the worst long-term droughts in modern history. Up to 60% of its land was devastated. 75% of farmers in the northeast and the south suffered total crop failure. Herders in the northeast lost around 85% of their livestock.
Let me get those numbers. You again, because I want to make sure people heard them. 75% of the farmland in Syria and 85% of the cattle herders were wiped out in this 5-year long drought from 2006 to 2011 in Syria alone.
That's right, in the northeast and in the south of Syria. And these are, you know, dry places that were experienced unprecedented drought that wiped them out. And now they had to go somewhere. The UN estimated about 1.5 million people were displaced. And most of these farmers and most of these herders moved into urban areas. And we didn't get a lot of coverage of that at the time because the Assad regime was blocking journalists from accessing those people. But those people were flooding into the cities at a time when Syrian cities were already economically depressed. You also had Iraqi refugees that had been flowing into those cities since 2003, as well as Palestinian refugees. And so you had a significant amount of unrest going on there. And we found that pretty interesting because right up to the day that the day before the Syrian revolution broke out in the southern rural town of Daraa, a number of experts were saying that Syria was immune to the Arab Spring and that it was generally a stable country. And that clearly wasn't the case. Now, what I'd say is climate is just one of those factors that can make things worse. I wouldn't say it directly caused the civil war, but it certainly was creating some pressures that led to a massive amount of displacement within Syria that could have contributed to unrest.
And this was at a time when there was food shortages. I think that people may remember this. There was a lot of food shortages because of this, because of the drought. And at the same time, as I understand it, in both Russia and in Canada, you had record rainy years that wiped out a lot of the crop, and there began to be food shortages. Bashar al-Assad controlled the grain harvest for the nation, and then I think explain this to me, Francesco. He sold it off 1 year to take advantage of these higher prices, and then the next year the nation was without food. And is that when the various riots and so forth over food prices began in the Middle East?
I mean, that was part of it, and there was in days of plenty that oftentimes regimes will do that sort of thing without thinking too far ahead. But the food price issue was is a broader global issue, and you also had in 2010 you had droughts in China that led China to buy a bunch of food on the global market, which drove up prices and also drove up prices in North Africa and the Middle East, where many of those countries are some of the greatest importers of wheat in the world. I think the nine of the top 10 wheat importers are in the Middle East and North Africa. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a dynamic. But I'd say in Syria, in terms of our own analysis, it wasn't necessarily just a food price issue. It was primarily an issue of farmers and herders just absolutely losing their livelihoods entirely. So in other countries like Egypt, food prices were an issue in the rural areas. But in Syria, you had such devastation that that you had a lot of internal displacement, and in our analysis, that was certainly something that was contributing to unrest. Whether or not it led directly to the revolt is unclear, because it's hard to get into Syria and study this sort of thing. There's a civil war, a bloody massacre happening. It's an issue, and we need to deal with it. And going forward, if we're not sort of incorporating environmental and climatic variables in how we look at security situations or the stability of a country, then we might miss these things again, as we did in Syria.
I'm speaking with Francesco Femia from the Center for Climate and Security. Over the Labor Day weekend at the Atlantic, they published a memo from William Polk, a longtime State Department policy planning veteran, no lefty granola crunching environmentalist. And he said that Syria has been convulsed by civil war since climate change came to Syria with a vengeance. He explains how farmers during this years-long drought desperately tapped aquifers with tens of thousands of new wells. But as they did, the water table level quickly dropped to a level below which their pumps could lift it. And as you said, these millions of people ended up coming into the cities because they were basically looking for work. They had lost their livelihoods. And now on top of that, lost jobs, skyrocketing food prices. It seems like it was a tinderbox then by the time we got to 2010. Syria, obviously, is not alone in this. There's elsewhere in the Arab Spring, they were affected by similar things. But what do you see across the globe, not just in the Middle East, as the threat multipliers, as you described them, that we need to be looking for when it comes to climate change in various parts of the world? Because the Defense Department is warning us about this. It just seems like the mainstream corporate media, who is not paying attention.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the Defense Department, the U.S. military, the intelligence community in the United States, takes climate change very seriously and does characterize it as a threat multiplier. And primarily, you know, climate change manifests itself through water. Are we going to get too much of it? Are we going to get too little? Is it going to come when we least expect it? Is rainfall going to get unpredictable? So it's really that sort of water variability, which is the main, you know, consequence of climate change. And so, and that impacts food security, as we've been talking about. You're going to see massive amounts, or you're going to see sea level rise along coastal areas in Asia, and also, you know, talking about the Middle East, you know, much of Egypt's economy is based around the Nile Delta in the coastal areas. We're seeing sea level rise there, where there's projected sea level rise there, and that salt water intrudes into freshwater aquifers, which makes that water useless. So you can't irrigate your crops, you can't get water to drink. So, you know, so those are the kinds of water issues that we're going to have to deal with. And clearly, as we see in these regions, you know, they're associated with internal displacement, and that can put pressures on a country that could lead to unrest. So that's one area. But I'd say another area is kind of more direct. You know, see, the U.S. Navy really cares about climate change because, frankly, the newest U.S. naval installations are at sea level rise, and are at sea level. So they need to take into account sea level rise and that, how that's going to impact, you know, naval installations, and how that's going to impact coastal economies, and how that's going to impact, you know, inland economies that depend on coastal economies for part of their economy. So I mean, there are a whole host of things that we need to look at as problems resulting from climate change, and in a lot of different areas. And that's why the Defense Department uses the term an accelerant of instability or a threat multiplier.
Yeah, indeed. Peter Sinclair of ClimateCrocs.com cited this. Let's call it irony for now. Back in January of 2010, in response to the Pentagon's Quadrennial Defense Review, then Senator John Kerry took a look at this review, came out and said, "I will tell you that the defense review of the United States Pentagon next week is going to come out and list climate change for the first time as an instability factor that affects our troops and may, in fact, wind up costing us lives down the road." That, ironically, was from then-Senator John Kerry, who is now Secretary of State John Kerry, arguing in favor of a military strike in Syria. On top of that, Francesco, last month in the journal Science, researchers reported the results of an analysis of 45 different conflict data sets and found strong causal evidence linking climate events to human conflict. When rainfall and temperature started to shift, the study found a systematic increase in the risk of many types of conflicts. Australia just put out a Policy Institute report on exactly this, saying climate change is transforming the conventional roles of security forces as a threat multiplier. It has the potential to generate and exacerbate destabilizing conditions that could reshape the regional security environment. So we're beginning already to see water wars around the country. And I would argue, Francesco, we're seeing hints of it even here in the U.S. Am I wrong about this? Is that a concern?
But, you know, water wars historically, you know, you haven't seen that many wars or conflicts that have happened over water. And actually, you see a lot of evidence that there's an opportunity there. When water's stressed, then people will oftentimes come together and try to figure out a solution because they need water. And so that we've seen that historically. But history is not going to tell us enough about what's going to happen in the future, because we're seeing unprecedented climatic changes and projected unprecedented changes in water variability and rainfall variability, et cetera. So for example, the intelligence community released an assessment earlier this year called the Water Security Assessment, which looks out, I think, 30 years. And they predicted that, you know, the levels of water stress we're going to see in the future could be so great that they could lead to conflict. And so, that is a real concern. And what I'd add also is that, you know, you mentioned Secretary then Senator Kerry talking about the Quadrennial Defense Review in 2010. But, going all the way back to the Bush administration, the Defense Department was taking climate change seriously. So this is not an Obama administration agenda. It's, you know, the mm-hmm. military, the National Defense Strategy in 2008, released by the Department of Defense, included climate change. There was a Marine Corps and Coast Guard strategy strategy in 2007 that included climate change, and then also something released by the United States Joint Forces Command in 2007 that included climate change. So we're talking about something that used to enjoy some kind of bipartisan support in terms of doing something about it, and this was the Bush administration. So the military and the national security community, they're taking it seriously, and the politics of the issue really have nothing to do with the reality.
Francisco Femia, in the 30 seconds I have left, what can we do, what should we do to help the situation, to bring it more into the forefront, and what actions, as you see it, and as the Center for Climate and Security see it, what actions need to be taken and on what timeline?
I think what we can do is our policymakers can start treating climate change as a security issue, not as some sort of special interest environmental issue. It needs to be looked at in the way that we look at, you know, other threats to security, like nuclear weapons proliferation or terrorism. You know, so we need to start thinking of this as a threat to security, international security and national security. And I think that, you know, once we start taking it seriously in that way, we'll start to see more bipartisan support for additional resources to both reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also put money into adapting to climate change. If we put a little bit of money in now, then we'll pay a lot less.
You know, I have little hope for Congress to do the right thing, until it becomes a crisis situation that they can't avoid. Do you see the media doing any better job, the corporate mainstream media, any signs of hope in that regard?
We do see, you know, evidence that the media is really starting to get back into looking at climate change as a real issue, including a security issue recently. And I think that's just because of the realities. We're seeing evidence of climate change growing, not just in the Arctic, but also potentially here in the United States, where we have we're living through an extended drought that's decimated a lot of the U.S. The productivity of U.S. farmland. So I think it's coming home, and people are starting to see it. The media is starting to see it again, and I think it's just a matter of time before policymakers have to deal with it. I mean, a lot of these places that are going to experience sea level rise, for example. The sea is not partisan, and so it's going to matter to Republicans, Democrats, Independents across the board. And I think it's only a matter of time before we start putting politics aside and doing something about it.
The sea is not partisan. You're right, and you are, of course, more optimistic than me as usual. But I'm going to go with you for now, Francesco Femia of the Center for Climate and Security. That's climateandsecurity.org, correct, Francesco?
That's right.
All right, great. Thank you very much for your time today, and I expect we'll be talking again in the future, sir. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Stopping the world and melting for you right here on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. We're going to take a very short break and then come back with much, much more new disclosures on the NSA, troubling disclosures from on the NSA and Israel from Edward Snowden, this terrible election bill in California that can affect the entire country, and Desi Doyen with the Green News Report. All of that is straight ahead right here on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
I'm Ian Masters, the host of Background Briefing, a daily news analysis program heard Mondays through Thursdays at 5 p.m. and on Sundays at 11 a.m. Each day, we look into three or four of the important stories and issues in the news to seek out the most knowledgeable specialists as well as the best-informed observers closest to the scene to provide you with an in-depth background briefing that has context, history, nuance, and details often overlooked by the spin and counterspin soundbite-driven mainstream corporate media. So for the best open source intelligence available on what's happening at home and abroad, tune in at 5 p.m. Mondays through Thursdays and on Sundays at 11 a.m. for your background briefing here on listener-sponsored independent radio at 90.7 FM KPFK.
You'll never know how much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa, whoa, closer.
Yeah. Plenty of secrets right here on KPFK. This is the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. New disclosures today from Edward Snowden, from his cache of documents. This, once again, broken by Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Ewan McCaskill in The Guardian. The National Security Agency routinely shares raw intelligence data with Israel without first sifting it to remove information about U.S. citizens, a top-secret document provided to The Guardian by whistleblower Edward Snowden reveals. Details of the intelligence-sharing agreement are laid out in a memorandum of understanding between the NSA and its Israeli counterpart that shows the U.S. government handed over intercepted communications likely to contain phone calls and emails of American citizens. The agreement places no legally binding limits on the use of the data by the Israelis. The disclosure that the NSA agreed to provide raw intelligence data to a foreign country contrasts with assurances from the Obama administration that there are rigorous safeguards to protect the privacy of U.S. citizens caught in the dragnet. The intelligence community calls this process minimization, but the memorandum makes clear that the information shared with the Israelis would be in its pre-minimized state. In other words, the information about U.S. persons, U.S. citizens, people living in the U.S., that was not removed before sharing it, apparently for years, with the Israeli government. The five-page memorandum, termed an agreement between the U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies, quote, pertaining to the protection of U.S. persons, repeatedly stresses the constitutional rights of Americans to privacy and the need for Israeli intelligence staff to respect those rights. But this is undermined by the disclosure that Israel is allowed to receive raw SIGINT, that's signal intelligence. The memorandum, according to The Guardian, says raw SIGINT includes, but is not limited to, unevaluated and unminimized transcripts, gists, facsimiles, telex, voice, and digital network intelligence, metadata, and content. According to the agreement, the intelligence being shared would not be filtered in advance by NSA analysts to remove U.S. communications. Quote, NSA routinely sends the Israeli SIGINT National Unit minimized and unminimized raw collection, the document says, although the memorandum is explicit in saying the material had to be handled in accordance with U.S. law and that the Israelis agreed not to deliberately target Americans identified in the data. These rules are not backed up by legal obligations. Quote, this agreement is not intended to create any legally enforceable rights and shall not be construed to be either an international agreement or a legally binding instrument according to international law, the document says. Notably, a much stricter rule was set for U.S. government communications found in the raw intelligence. The Israelis were required. Yeah, this is interesting. The Israelis were required to destroy upon recognition any communication, quote, that is either to or from an official of the U.S. government. Such communications included those of, quote, officials of the executive branch, including the White House, cabinet departments, and independent agencies, the U.S. House of Representatives, and Senate member and staff, and the U.S. federal court system, including but not limited to the Supreme Court. So, in other words, they were required, according to this agreement, to destroy upon any recognition any communication that came from anybody in the government. You know, protect the White House, protect the Congress, protect the courts. As far as protecting the people, the citizens, nothing in there. No, just try to avoid that stuff if you can. This is just amazing to me. The Guardian goes on to say, with much of the world's internet traffic passing through U.S. networks, large numbers of purely domestic communications get scooped up incidentally by the agency's surveillance programs. While NSA documents tout the mutually beneficial relationship of SIGINT sharing with Israel, another report marked top secret and dated September 2007 states that the relationship, while central to U.S. strategy, has become overwhelmingly one-sided in favor of Israel. In another top secret document, this is what's amazing to me, in another top secret document seen by The Guardian dated 2008, a senior NSA official points out that Israel aggressively spies on the U.S. Quote, according to the secret document, top secret document, quote, on the one hand, the Israelis are extraordinarily good SIGINT partners for us. But on the other, they target us to learn our positions on Middle East problems, the official says. Quote, a national intelligence estimate ranked them as the third most aggressive intelligence service against the U.S. So I guess that puts Israel behind China and Russia? As far as people spying on us, as far as countries spying on us? Oh, brother. Later in the document, the official is quoted as saying, one of NSA's biggest threats is actually from friendly intelligence services like Israel. There are parameters on what NSA shares with them, but the exchange is so robust, we sometimes share more than we intended. That, according to The Guardian, the new documents published by The Guardian, leaked by Edward Snowden to them today. That is disturbing, particularly then when you take into account a report from March 2011 from Marcy Wheeler over at Empty Wheel. She reports, she actually highlights this report from 2011 that she ran over there, quoting Haaretz, military Israeli newspaper, reporting that the Israel's military intelligence set up groups earlier that year in 2011, 2010, dedicated to collecting intelligence on non-Israeli leftist organizations that are critical of Israel. This is from Haaretz. Quote, military intelligence is collecting information about left-wing organizations abroad that the army sees as aiming to delegitimize Israel. Now, they're talking about military intelligence in Israel. This is according to senior Israeli officials and Israel Defense Forces officers. The sources said military intelligence research division created a department several months ago that is dedicated to monitoring left-wing groups and will work closely with government ministries. Military intelligence officials said the initiative reflects on an upsurge in worldwide efforts to delegitimize Israel and question its right to exist. Quote, the enemy changes, as does the nature of the struggle, and we have to boost activity in this sphere, an MI official said. Work on this topic proceeds on the basis of a clear distinction between legitimate criticism of the state of Israel on the one hand and efforts to harm it and undermine its right to exist on the other. The new MI unit will monitor Western groups involved in boycotting Israel. I guess a boycott is now a threat to Israel that that intelligence agencies need to look into. Groups involved in boycotting Israel, divesting from it, or imposing sanctions on it. The unit will also collect information about groups that attempt to bring war crime or other charges against high-ranking Israeli officials and examine possible links between such organizations and terror groups. That was the Israeli paper Haaretz back in March of 2011. So they are keeping their eye on Western groups that may be boycotting them, Western groups that may be concerned about Israel, claiming war crimes by Israel. Israel has an interest in keeping their eyes on them. And at the same time, we now learn today via Edward Snowden that the NSA is dumping all of this intelligence to Israel. Phone calls, content, email, data, metadata, giving it to Israel, including information on U.S. citizens. So can we connect some dots there? Marcy Wheeler goes on to write, "Now, aside from thinking generally that this is a bad idea, I'm particularly concerned about whether or not the U.S. will share intelligence with Israel on such issues." So that was back in 2011. We now know they are sharing a great deal of data with Israel. She cites the book The Shadow Factory by James Bamford, who spent some time detailing the Israeli ties to key companies in our electronic surveillance, companies like Verint, which intercepts and stores communications, Per Se, which does voice mining, NICE, or N-I-C-E, which does voice content analysis, and NARUS, which enables real-time surveillance on telecom lines. Between Verint and NARUS, Bamford writes, "Thus, virtually the entire American telecommunications system is bugged by two Israeli-formed companies with possible ties to Israel's eavesdropping agency with no oversight by Congress." Again, that was a couple of years ago. Those were the private companies that were able to bug Lord knows how many American people. And now we learn the NSA was helping them out, was making it easy for them. An amazing story. But you know what? It's Barack Obama. We don't have to worry. We can trust him. He's a Democrat, right? Man, I can't tell you the number of O-bots who I hear that from. Yeah, Obama bots. I'm talking to you. Who I hear that from. It's Obama. We don't have to worry about him. Again, even if you don't have to worry about him, you do have to worry about the next person who's going to take that office. Man. All right, let me get to this California story, because this also is an incredible story, and this affects the entire country, not just California. Before I do, though, I'm going to give a heads up. We've got a bit of an announcement here. Coming up September, 28th, Saturday, September 28th. For those of you in Los Angeles, I hope you will join me and a bunch of other great people for a screening of Shadows of Liberty. You can find out about this film at shadowsofliberty.org. I appear in it once or twice, but it's good anyway. And we're going to have a free screening out here in Los Angeles, September 28th, Saturday. Mark that down on your calendar. We'll have more details in the days ahead. We're going to have a panel. We're going to have the filmmaker. I think Jason Leopold is going to be joining us. It's about the effect of the corporate media. And that's pretty much everything that we talk about on this show. The effect of the corporate media monopoly on the information that Americans receive. The whistleblowers that are shut down, the stories that aren't reported. It's an extraordinary film. So more details in the days ahead about that. Check out the teaser for the film for now at shadowsofliberty.org. And of course, we will have more information at kpfk.org. Okay. Few more minutes here, and then we're going to bring on Desi Doyen. Des, you ready? Are you warming up for the green news in there? Okay. We talked last week about this California bill, this terrible California bill, SB 360. At the time, it was sailing through the state legislature. Well, the bad news is, as of late Friday, it passed both houses with almost no debate at all. Along strict party lines, the bill is now being sent to Governor Jerry Brown. I wrote about it in some detail yesterday at bradblog.com, but let me read you a bit of that article. A new bill that would grant unprecedented and unchecked powers to the California Secretary of State, including those that could allow him or her to approve new voting systems for use in actual elections with no testing at all, was approved late last week by the state legislature along partisan lines. The governor should veto SB 360, a sweeping, dangerous, ill-conceived, and dishonestly presented piece of legislation passed with little debate in public or in either chamber of the state legislature. The measure has been and is being deceptively sold to the public and to state lawmakers as necessary to allow California counties, specifically Los Angeles County, the largest voting jurisdiction in the nation, to develop, own, and operate public voting systems. In fact, the bill does much more, much, much more than that. What it actually does, among other things, is it ends the longstanding requirement that all electronic voting systems used in the state of California be tested and certified at the federal level before even being considered for use here in California. The bill also includes a provision allowing for new voting systems to be used in pilot programs during, quote, a legally binding election before the system has been certified by the state in any way. That, in effect, would allow new systems to be used in an actual election by actual California voters without any independent testing whatsoever. Now, that should be a serious concern, not just to folks in California, not just in Los Angeles, where they're developing a new voting system, but across the entire state and across the entire country, because the purposes of the system they are developing here in Los Angeles, aside from serving some 4 million voters in L.A. County here, we are larger. It's the largest voting jurisdiction in the nation. It is larger than 36 other complete states as far as voters go. That system is being developed with an eye to sell it to the rest of the state and to sell it to the rest of the country. And it could very well be done. It actually will be done if the governor signs this without any federal testing whatsoever and only as much state testing as the next Secretary of State decides is necessary. Oh, and by the way, this bill, which is being deceptively sold to people, was authored by State Senator Alex Padilla, who happens to be, right now, the leading 2004 candidate for Secretary of State. Got that? This bill will give sweeping, unprecedented powers to the Secretary of State, and it has been authored by the guy who very well may be the next Secretary of State. Furthermore, Senator Padilla, who has refused to reply to any of my many queries, going all the way back to earlier this year when I've been trying to get details on this and why he thinks it's a good idea to do away with federal testing of voting systems, why he thinks it's a good idea to create a law that wouldn't even allow, from my reading, and that reading has been confirmed by a lot of folks who I've talked to who are in a position to know, let me just put it that way, that would not require any testing at all before these voting systems are used in actual elections with millions of voters here in Los Angeles. So it's being deceptively sold by saying, hey, we need non-proprietary systems, publicly owned systems. We want to allow counties to develop voting systems instead of having to rely on Diebold and ES&S and all of these terrible companies. Well, that's a good idea. And I'm not against that. But what Padilla is not telling people is that we are already allowed in California to have publicly owned non-proprietary voting systems. In fact, here in Los Angeles County, we have such a system. It is owned by LA County. Now, if LA wants to develop a new system, that's fine. They're allowed to do that. But if they want to use monies from the Help America Vote Act and from the Voting Modernization Act that was passed here a few years ago in 2002 in California, if they want to use those monies, in fact, the law would have to change because the money in those funds is only available for systems that have already been federally certified. Okay, fine. The very first version of this bill from Senator Padilla did just that. It freed up the money so that LA County or other counties could develop their own systems without having federal certification first, but required that they would then have to get federal certification for this new system before it could be used on actual guinea pigs. I'm sorry, voters. That original version of the bill, by the way, was 4 pages long. It was fine. It was 4 pages long. It changed 3 sections of the California election code. The version that was passed last week is 40 pages long. It's a mess. It changes more than 70 sections of the California Election Code. Now, I could go into detail, I won't bore you for now, about the bad idea that it is to give this kind of unrestrained, unprecedented power to a Secretary of State. In California, we have a recent history, as does the rest of the country, with disastrous voting systems, with voting systems that have been found to have huge flaws, huge security bugs. These are systems that were already federally certified and state certified. And yet they still ended up having bugs that nobody found through both of those testing processes. Why the hell would anyone want to get rid of an entire level of testing? Why would we want less testing rather than more on our voting systems? Now, one of the excuses I've heard from supporters of this bill is that the federal testing is done by the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission, the EAC, who has no commissioners right now because Congress refuses. Republicans in Congress want to kill the agency, so they're refusing to confirm any commissioners at the top of that federal commission, the EAC. However, the EAC continues with their testing of new voting systems. I've confirmed this with Brian Hancock, the director of the EAC's testing and certification system, with other people there at the EAC on record, all of whom have said, yes, our testing moves ahead apace, even without commissioners at the top of the EAC. I spoke with Dean Logan, the county clerk out here in Los Angeles, a few months ago, right here on the broadcast. And he told me, well, we need to do away with federal testing in California because the EAC is broken. He said, there's no commissioners. We can't do testing there anymore. And of course, that was not true, or at least it is disputed by the EAC. Now, I am no fan of the EAC. As a matter of fact, no one has been more of a pain in the ass to the EAC over the years, I suspect, than the Brad blog. You can search bradblog.com for page after page of us, frankly, beating the crap out of the EAC for their failures on many levels. That said, more testing is better than less testing. And the fact that this bill, now on Jerry Brown's desk, will allow new voting systems with no federal testing at all ever again, and potentially no state testing at all either, is utter madness. Governor Jerry Brown needs to veto this bill. And that's even, by the way, with some of the big election integrity organizations, Big Vote, can we call them Big Vote? Big Election? Out there supporting this bill, and even Secretary of State Deborah Bowen supports this bill. They are wrong to do so. You can read my report at bradblog.com for the details on just how bad this bill is, but I would also urge you to contact the governor and contact the governor quickly with your opinion on this bill. You can contact Governor Jerry Brown, give him your opinion on SB 360 at gov, that's gov.ca.gov. That's gov.ca.gov. Select contact from the menu there, and when it says please choose your subject, there's a drop-down list, and you can state SB 360 in the drop-down box, or you can call them. Their phone number is 916-445-2841 if you'd like to contact Governor Jerry Brown concerning a veto on SB 360. That's 916-445-2841, or you can stop by gov.ca.gov and let them know that, no, it's not a good idea to do away with all federal testing for new voting systems in California. It's not good for California, and frankly, it's not good for the rest of the country. All right, let's do some green news.
It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things.
Yeah, grab a microphone.
Yeah, that helps.
There you go.
Hold
people there. Kind of pass you hey, of course, we're, as usual, running late by the time you get here. Sorry. However, before we get to the green news, I saw that you were in a fight today, a Twitter fight with CNBC. What's up with that?
Oh, a Twitter fight with CNBC anchor Joe Kernan, who is a dedicated anti-climate science denier.
And what did he say?
All about talking about how he apparently thinks he knows better than actual published climate scientists who've been publishing in this century.
Are you saying the Wall Street and Economic Reporters of CNBC don't know climate science better than actual climate scientists?
That is what I am saying.
And so
yes.
You were fighting with them. Your Twitter handle is?
Green News Report.
And you're kind of making me look bad because, you know, in this duo, I'm supposed to be the heavy. I'm the bad cop. You're the good cop. Everybody loves you. I'm the guy who gets into Twitter fights. And now you're out there punching CNBC in the face on the Twitter.
Well, I couldn't resist. It was too funny.
Okay, good. Well, you could check. Somebody's got no more Mr. Nice Guy as far as you're concerned.
Yes.
Okay. We'll check that out at Green News Report on the Twitters. By the way, I am the Brad Blog on the Twitters, fighting nightly with people there. As a matter of fact, check that out. All right, but let's do some green news. This is our latest green news report.
I declare that Australia is under new management and that Australia is once more open for business.
Fossil fuel industry and Rupert Murdoch win. Climate activists lose in Australia's election. Record heat wave closes schools from Michigan to Ohio. Texas residents sue BP. Plus,
when they see electric cars racing fast with drivers that are cool guys and so on, they will think an electric car is something interesting.
The future of car racing is electrifying.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
As a weatherman, let me ask you something. On the maps, why is the sun wearing sunglasses?
Well, that's a very good question.
The Earth should wear the sunglasses.
Well,
it's like an oven wearing oven mitts.
Yeah.
This is your Green News Report.
It makes no sense to me.
Okay, Desi Doyen, during one of our reports last week, I was a little bit snarky.
What, you snarky?
Yeah, I was a little bit snarky about climate change helping to spark the mess we now see in Syria. And it was mostly for comic effect, but I wanted to point out you were absolutely right. And I covered some of those details in a report at bradblog.com showing exactly how climate change directly led to this mess we are now seeing in Syria.
Yeah, most people don't know that 4 years of brutal drought from 2006 to 2012 turned more than half of Syria into desert, collapsing much of its agriculture industry, causing food shortages. The Defense Department calls climate change a threat multiplier.
And in this case, that is exactly what it was. But good catch, and sorry for the snark.
Oh, we love the snark. That's what you do for a living.
What do you have for us today?
Well, first, a record heat wave is blistering the upper Midwest and breaking long-standing heat records for September. The National Weather Service has issued an extended heat advisory with temperatures pushing 100 degrees, 15 degrees above normal, forcing officials to close schools and open emergency cooling centers across Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio. Meanwhile, school kids in Australia are having a similar but arguably worse problem.
We got evacuated because we had a bushfire in front of our school.
Bushfire season is off to a record early and brutal start with high winds and a surprise heat wave that ignited 60 bushfires around the capital of Sydney in just 48 hours. So while Australia is broiling in yet another record heat wave, Australians just elected a new Conservative Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who said this as his very first act.
In 3 years' time, the carbon tax will be gone.
Yes, that's right. With a record heat wave, the new Prime Minister will immediately begin dismantling Australia's carbon tax on its biggest industrial polluters.
So this is a huge win for the fossil fuel industry, a huge win for Rupert Murdoch, who has been supporting this guy, trying to roll back this landmark carbon tax that was just put in place within the past year.
Right. Abbott has previously said that he thinks global warming is, quote, absolute crap, and that is the big flaw in a carbon tax. It can be repealed. Abbott's win, as you said, was also fueled in part by Rupert Murdoch's Australia media empire, which has hammered the carbon tax in Australia relentlessly. On Sunday, Murdoch's Wall Street Journal warned U.S. politicians against even talking about a carbon tax on industrial polluters in the United States.
Shut up or the environment gets it.
Exactly. Oil giant BP has decided it is done paying damages to Gulf Coast residents for its massive 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh, that's nice. They're done.
Oh, yeah. And they're fighting tooth and nail in federal court to get out of paying any more. Now, BP is being sued by 50,000 Texas residents who live near BP's troubled refinery in Texas City after BP admitted to knowingly venting toxic chemicals, including benzene, into the air for 5 months in 2010. They admitted using a faulty unit that the company knew was not capable of stopping the airborne toxins. This is the same troubled BP refinery where an explosion killed 15 people in 2005.
So they're admitting they know all of these things, but they're not willing to pay up?
Right. They're arguing in court that no one was injured.
How thoughtful of them.
Meanwhile, Shell Oil has agreed to pay a whopping $1 million fine to settle claims that it violated air pollution permits during its comically tragic attempts to drill in the U.S. Arctic last summer.
Oh, my.
$1 million.
That $1 million fine is 0.02% of its profits over the last 3 months. Finally, European car maker Renault thinks the future of racing is electric and just debuted its all-electric Formula E racing car to be used in the first ever Formula E racing season next year, which they hope will ignite interest in electric cars.
When they see electric cars racing fast with drivers that are cool guys and so on, they will think an electric car is something interesting, fun, and they will be more inclined to buy it.
I had a really cool electric slot car track when I was growing up. Does that count?
No, not the same thing.
Okay. For much more on that story and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports via iTunes, via Stitcher, via TuneIn Radio. Make sure you find us and like us on the Facebook and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Go Speed Racer, Go Speed Racer, Go Speed Racer, go!
Boom, I just cheered myself up with Speed Racer.
Well, I'm sorry to bring you down again, but just some breaking news. I'm sorry to say, but fracking looks like it has been green-lighted now in the state of California. SB4, a bill to implement the first ever comprehensive fracking regulations in California, passed the Assembly today, 47-17, and it looks like it requires fracking to continue until the regulations can get around to being written.
Just the Assembly or the entire
You know, I have to double-check on that, but I know for sure, the Assembly 47-17.
Okay, well, a good excuse to give the governor's contact number again out here in California, 916-445-2841, or his website, gov.ca.gov. I wanted you to go there to complain about SB 360 and ask for a veto on that terrible election bill.
Complain about SB4, too.
There you go. My thanks to you, Desi Doyen, our producer here today. My thanks, as always, to G, our great soundboard operator. Also, to our guests, Francesco Femia of climateandsecurity.org. Stay tuned for John Wiener in the 4 o'clock report. He'll have more on Syria and on the other 9/11. Yes, 40 years to the day after the Chilean coup with historian Heidi Tinsman. Where else are you going to find this much content, this much information in 1 hour of radio? We'll be back same Brad time, same Brad channel next week. Until then, you can find me at bradblog.com and on the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Good night, America. I'm Brad Friedman.